You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 17th of January 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello from Studio One here in London, and welcome to Midori House. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's show...
This program does not involve the content of phone calls or the names of people making calls. Instead, it provides a record of phone numbers and the times and lengths of calls.
From NSA phone surveillance to French presidential affairs, we'll discuss the day's top stories with Peter York and Jeffrey Kaufman here in the studio. Also ahead...
My name is Jordan Belfort. The year I turned 26, I made $49 million, which really pissed me off because it was three shy of a million a week.
We'll review the very best in cinema releases with film critic Alex Godfrey. We'll also meet the man behind London's Delfina Foundation, check in with our correspondent in sunny Rio de Janeiro, and play a bit of music too. That's all coming here on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So, lots coming up here in the next hour on Midori House. But before all of that, here's David Spencer with the latest news.
Thank you, Monocle 24 News. I'm David Spencer. Barack Obama has announced a series of reforms to the work of America's National Security Agency, including the reining in of the vast collection of phone data. He said the rush to respond to real threats had led the government to overreach itself. The president said he would ban eavesdropping on the leaders of close friends and allies. His long-awaited speech comes after the revelations from Edward Snowden about the extent of the NSA's surveillance. While admitting mistakes had been made, Mr. Obama criticized the way the NSA's information had been leaked.
If any individual who objects to government policy can take it into their own hands to publicly disclose classified information, then we will not be able to keep our people safe or conduct foreign policy. Moreover, the sensational way in which these disclosures have come out has often shed more heat than light, while revealing methods to our adversaries that could impact our operations in ways that we may not fully understand for years to come.
The Syrian government has proposed a local ceasefire and an exchange of prisoners ahead of planned peace talks next week. The statement, which was made by the Syrian foreign minister in Moscow, suggests a truce in Aleppo, Syria's biggest city. It comes as opposition groups meet in Turkey to decide whether to attend the conference in Switzerland. But splits between different members have already emerged, with 44 members of the coalition announcing they won't take part in talks. Spokesman for the breakaway members, Khalid Ali.
We refuse most of the policies now inside the coalition. Most of them doesn't reflect the attitude of the revolutionists inside Syria. So for that, we are out of these meetings now.
At least 28 people have been injured after an explosive device was thrown at anti-government protesters in the Thai capital, Bangkok. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra has again refused to resign, saying next month's election is the only way to end the crisis. At least 8 people have died in demonstrations that started in November over a controversial amnesty bill. South Sudan's defense minister says the leader of rebels battling government forces does not have enough control over his fighters to make any ceasefire hold. Troops loyal to President Salva Kiir and rebels backing the deputy he sacked in July, Riek Machar, have been fighting since mid-December, and peace talks have continued with no sign of a deal. South Sudan says it could ask Sudan for military help if the conflict in the world's newest nation threatens its valuable oil fields. In Detroit, a 4-year-old boy has died after his cousin accidentally shot him while playing with a rifle she found inside a relative's home. The cousin is also 4 years old. The boy was pronounced dead after being taken to hospital. The grandparents whose home it was were not there at the time and had left the children in the care of a family friend. French gossip magazine Closer has made further allegations against President François Hollande, claiming an affair with actress Julie Gayet began 2 years ago. Last week, the magazine published photographs, which it said supported its claims. Gayet has since threatened to sue. Meanwhile, Mr. Hollande has visited his current partner in hospital after she became ill last weekend, days after the allegations emerged. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, David. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and we'll be right back after this.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦, 这是 Monocle 24.
Ot London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House, and the time here in London now is 18.06, which means it's 13.06 in New York. And joining me now with their take on the news is the author and cultural commentator Peter York, and also Geoffrey Kaufman, London correspondent for ABC News. Gentlemen, welcome both to the programme. We're going to start with a story that's been dominating the headlines all today, and certainly for some days as well. That's the fact that US President Barack Obama has responded to the growing anger over NSA surveillance, both domestically and globally. Obama held a press conference this afternoon where he strongly defended NSA phone monitoring, but also laid out new procedures that he said would help suppress abuse by the surveillance authorities. Geoffrey, what's your take on what we've seen so far today? So just looking at the announcement he's made, he hasn't really kind of said what will follow in its place. He's just kind of said we will make some changes.
I think my first take is, how naive are we, all of us, to playfully send catty text messages to friends and send photographs and emails about colleagues or whatever, and to think that somebody's not going to have access to this stuff. I mean, I think this Orwellian world is so present now and so out of control. And it is true, as Obama said today, that the technology got ahead of our ability to regulate it. And that's what's now, he's trying to harmonize the two. I guess the biggest thing that he's done today is announced that there'll be this form of a secret court to authorize access to this vast trove of information. But I think that we're entering an era of utter distrust. I think that we all, we're not paranoid if they really are after us, as Richard Nixon said. And I think that we have reason to feel that this is not going to be enough, that as much as they say they're only after bad guys, the absolute scale of this, as we see in a Guardian piece today, based on Edward Snowden's latest revelations, is staggering.
Now, Peter, they say that they're collecting hundreds of millions of messages and interceptions of phone calls. They can't really be sifting through all of those. Does it make you personally concerned that people are reading your text messages or something? Or do you feel that this is, not great, but just one of those things that people aren't that alarmed by, really?
You feel sorry for them, anybody who'd had to do it. And you think, is this clever or is this dumb? Is this clever because there are a set of objectives, a set of algorithms that are much cleverer than anybody lets on? Or is it dumb in terms of American giantism, just over-responding, overusing the technology, not being selective or clever or imaginative about how you actually do define the bad guys? Has it worked? I'd love to know. And of course, we never will. To what extent it's been useful so far?
I think the only thing that, Peter, your point is valid. The one thing that is in our favor as individual citizens who are not terrorists and don't want to be is that there is so much information out there that we can only hope that we're all of it's being drowned in this sea, as you say. What do you do when you have hundreds of millions of phone calls and text messages? I think the side of it that I think does make people anxious is, what if some guy in the CIA or here in London at the GCHQ says, what about that neighbor, you know, who bugs me? Let me just put his name in.
Yes,
and who's going to stop him? I mean, how will we ever know if I'm in GCHQ and I put in Peter York and find out some things and access and find, oh, he's been calling so-and-so. Mm. You know, and I think that we have reason to worry about on that micro scale as much as on the macro governmental scale.
I think Peter's phone records might make interesting reading, but they'll
be on monocle.com.
But Jeffrey, let me ask you, the strange thing is, you know, in America, this is getting a huge amount of publicity. Everyone's kind of concerned at what the president is saying. But there's certainly no demonstrations on the street here in London, even though we believe that GCHQ has been involved in many of the same acts and has certainly been helping the Americans. Why is it strange? And, you know, we have a court case rumbling on, which is to do with privacy in the press, where people did get outraged. But why do you think that people just aren't that angry about it?
As someone who grew up in Canada, worked in the U.S. and now lives in the U.K., I think that this illustrates really the cultural differences and the role of the citizen in government, the attitudes towards liberty and libertarianism. And I think it's no surprise, anyone who, you don't have to be a scholar of American history to understand that the notion of liberty and freedom from government intrusion is fundamental. It's in the DNA of really all Americans. And so that's what Obama is being forced to respond to.
Peter, before you just come back in, let's just hear President Obama. This was him this afternoon talking about the NSA.
This is not unique to America. Few, if any, spy agencies around the world constrain their activities beyond their own borders. And the whole point of intelligence is to obtain information that is not publicly available. But America's capabilities are unique. And the power of new technologies means that there are fewer and fewer technical constraints on what we can do. That places a special obligation on us to ask tough questions about what we should do.
Well, he's kind of saying there, be grown up. You know, we know that this goes on. You know, you know what your government does. You don't really believe that your government is only kind of watching its own citizens. You know that they're kind of spying on other foreign leaders. What was your take on that, Peter?
Well, he says that is wonderful, elegant, plangent, liberal, considered, you know, senior common room things. And then he makes jokes about the drones. Do you remember, famously, with a whole bunch of White House correspondents, he sort of said, toe the line or I'll drone you. Now, that's quite worrying, because at the end of the day, I can't see what the commitment is here to changing anything fast. I can't see any commitment.
I think he's trying to build in some sort of accountability chain, but the problem is that accountability chain is accountable to who?
Yeah.
And it's nice that there's going
secret
to be a
secret court.
Right, a secret court will now have to be involved. Yeah. How will any of us be able to access that court to find out if our rights have been abused? And will that secret court go randomly looking at citizens in search of nasty things?
But Jeffrey, you know, the idea was, you know, I think that many people are thinking there should be, you know, a separate private body that holds of all this information, and then, you know, the NSA can request information as and when it needs it. But the fact is, we all know that it's doing is pulling together the information that sits with the phone companies anyway. So it's not as though this information doesn't exist. You know, everything we do, whether we like it or not, you know, it's for our phone bills, it's for our internet.
Sure.
It does exist.
But Vodafone here or Verizon Wireless in the U.S. is not looking through our phone records. But you do bring up an interesting point that Obama did not, an issue people were looking at today, and he did not resolve it. And that is how this NSA snooping is affecting American trade. Huge amounts of hardware and computer software, obviously, are a big part of American exports. And American companies are facing boycotts by nations around the world who believe that the NSA has cracked this hardware and this software, and that if the Chinese or the German government buy it, that the U.S. security complex will be able to penetrate into this very dense machinery. And Obama did not close that door. He's been under great pressure from Silicon Valley to do that, and he did not.
Peter, you've done lots of advising on brands about what they do with their image and how they manage their image. You know, if you're an Apple or a Google, and now you're kind of implicated in this whole mess, is that a scary thing?
Yes. The public affairs people and the lobbyists for those brands, hitherto regarded as, you know, front runners of the new world, and in a way, sort of liberal and liberating brands, because they encourage transparency, of course, nothing of the kind, have found themselves up against a global brick wall that says, we don't like those brands, they spy on us, and they don't pay their local taxes. And do you know, there's very, very considerable reaction against those magic Silicon Valley brands. And all, you know, all those new world American brands are facing it. Not just, you know, in every bit of the world, certainly here.
But I find that...
you feel bad about Starbucks.
But the contradiction... I know Starbucks knows exactly what kind of coffee we drink.
Yes.
But the contradiction in what you're saying, and fundamentally I agree with you, is that as much as people are suspect or circumspect about these brands, they are still flocking to them, whether it be Facebook or
sure.
Apple or the wireless companies.
Well, we're going to move on now. And we're going to turn our attention to France, where François Hollande... I'm not sure he's having the greatest weekend ahead for him. It's been announced today that he has gone finally and visited the First Lady in hospital. And the magazine Closer has also come out with even more revelations, more comment today, saying that the affair that he's been having has actually been going on for potentially since 2011, in what they're describing in a very nice French way as an eventful idyll. They've said that with his lover, he's had many ruptures and reconciliations. And we're waiting to see whether, with Valerie Trierweiler, whether he will manage a reconciliation or want one, indeed, because, of course, there are rumours that his lover is actually 4 months pregnant. I guess what's happened around the world is there's a sense that, you know, for the Anglophone world, we can't believe that he's kind of got away with it, Peter.
No, but we don't understand. There's somebody saying, you know, the 22-mile gap is a complete, vast cultural gap, particularly about things like this. And the difference between our newspapers at every level, you know, because newspapers are really the leaders on running with this sort of story or not, even though that this in this case it was magazine, we can't believe the fantastic respect that people pay to their presidents in France. In the same way, with it, we can't believe quite how boring American newspapers can be. It's absolutely amazing wading through that. And we've got hyena-like journalists who love this sort of thing, and a nation that loves this sort of thing and feels, and still neck curtain twitching, no better than they ought to be. And we'd have this in a minute. You can't imagine that anything like this is taking place between, let's say, Sam and Dave.
Now, Jeffrey, do you think morality still matters?
Do I think morality? How many hours do we have here? You know, I think that what we're seeing here is that morality depends upon where you're looking at it from, and I think from France the view of what you call morality is very different, and clearly the line that you keep hearing here is that every French president since de Gaulle has had a mistress. And so what's new here? What's new is that Hollande has been a catastrophic president with sinking poll numbers since he was elected in 2012. And actually, he saw a bump in his favorability ratings as a result of this.
Well, the incredible thing is it's also women voters who seem to like him even more. Young women voters and kind of there's a middle ground that aren't so keen. But older and younger women have warmed to him over this.
Yeah, I think that the interesting thing about what Peter says is, yes, it's true. In the U.S. as well as in the U.K. and probably in Canada, the press would be all over this. And politicians would have a tough time, as Bill Clinton discovered. They might survive, but they would certainly be raked for the coals. The French are different and they have a different value system. And clearly there is you get a big free pass. Now, what's happening in this globalized world is that I think values are starting to merge. And I think that a lot of French journalists came under heavy attack for their lack of, for their deference in that press conference that Hollande held this week. Only one question out of several dozen questions was about this. The first question, he read his scripted answers and then they talked about the economy. Thank you very much. That would be inconceivable, not just in the UK, but in the US and other countries.
We were talking there, you know, his numbers are interesting, but also this idea of a globalised world. It's not that globalised because the French are very different from everybody else, as you've said.
I think we always suspect when these things come out in an unusual context, a context where normally things are deferential, and it's come through a medium, which is really a global gossip brand magazine. It's come through there and you think, has somebody willed it? And did they will it? Because there are a lot of people who would like Hollande out. And has it misfired if it's increased, at the end of the day, increased his poll ratings? But was it meant as a somewhat more right-wing shot? Was it meant as a sort of torpedo? In that rather marginal, Closer is quite a marginal publication in the great world. But why did it come out there? Why did it come out then? Why did nobody else do it?
Let's just remind our listeners that Closer was in the news just over a year ago because it published those topless pictures of the then Kate Middleton. I mean, this is, this is, calling it marginal, I think, is being generous.
No. Yes. Well, it's not in the great mainstream thinking French journalism.
And when he came to power, Geoffrey, he was saying that he would be Mr. Normal.
Apparently he is by French standards. Next question.
Okay, well, maybe we've done enough of that. It's all about secrets and lies here in the first half of the show. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. And have no fear, Peter York and Geoffrey Kaufman are going to stick around for a bit longer. But first, there's this.
Each Sunday on Monocle 24, we like to take stock.
The wonder of history for the journalist is you can delve into this immense booty of information.
You don't write a book lightly, and I didn't really want to write a book, so I had to find something which could only be explained in a book.
Take the Global Pulse.
Singapore is too small to have a known huge art scene to be competitive on a global level.
The old distinction between policy being made in London and executed by diplomats abroad has gone.
A lot of people come south for the opium harvest, and literally as soon as the last opium poppy is harvested, they will then take up arms and fight for a few weeks. It's purely practical.
And occasionally take things down a notch too.
I mean, if someone wants to buy it for $100 million, we would sell it.
Our radio station's got quite a wealthy demographic. I think you're in the right place.
To end the week with the best chat.
I've been confused for Kenny Loggins, actually.
I want to start with a very simple question. Why did we go to war with Iraq?
Some great music.
A grand piano is kind of a condescending icon at this point.
And some good fun to set up Sunday and warm the week ahead. The Monocle Weekly. Your week starts here.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Peter York and also Geoffrey Kaufman. We're going to look now at the latest cover for Time magazine. It's generated a lot of comments, some positive, some more negative. It features the headline, "Can Anyone Stop Hillary?" along with a big pantsuited leg and high heel and a dangling man on the heel's tip. Lots of people have decided it's sexist and it's wrong. What's up with you, Peter? Is the pantsuit a sexist comment?
I think it's a very old. It's a very old fashioned. It looks like a cover or a poster from the 1970s. But sorry, she's an exciting thought, isn't she, Hillary? She's an exciting thought for them.
Geoffrey, while Peter takes a glass of water, horrified by the image that he's seen of the pantsuited woman, what was your reading of that picture?
Listen, I think Time magazine has accomplished exactly what it tries to do every week and rarely does. It's got us talking about Time magazine. Yes. I'm not the brand guy here, but this is brilliant marketing. Is it offensive? Some people say it's sexist, but you know, here's a woman with a miniaturized man. It's the 50-foot woman with the 5-inch man dangling onto her shoe, trying to stay attached. It's provocative. That's what journalism's meant to be, and that's what this graphic is. And it does raise the point: is she unstoppable? What's interesting, I think, is that the image itself is now being talked about so much that I think nobody's actually talking about what's in the article, which is really quite a good article.
Peter, we'll return to you post-cough. Just tell me, when you looked at the image, you were saying it was very old-fashioned. It was 1970s advertising. just tell us a little bit more about what you thought of the image and this notion that, you know, Hillary is kind of unstoppable now.
Well, I've got my doubts. I mean, she's got to transfer from being big sister to mother of the nation by the time the election comes. I'm not sure she's unstoppable. I think the idea that, having had a black president, America could have a female president is sort of unstoppable because, to preempt something we're going to be thinking about, America is a changed and changing nation because the electorate is different. And that's a big idea that, you know, it's worth having and worth talking about for time. And of course, though it's a very old-fashioned image, it's almost, I mean, it's, you take it back, it's like anything under the heel of anything is a sort of First World War bit of imagery. It's a very arresting one on the cover of Time, which needs something arresting.
and it does let us say the word pantsuit, which you don't get to say.
Pantsuit.
I like
yeah,
the word
pantsuit.
Yeah,
but she does wear a pantsuit.
Which is another very archaic garment.
I would point out two things. It does, the cover line does have a question mark. It says, "Can anyone stop Hillary?" Question mark. It does not make it a foregone conclusion. It simply is being provocative. But I think the other thing that has to be kept in mind is that a month ago we might have said, can anyone stop New Jersey Governor Chris Christie from getting the Republican nomination to run against Hillary or whoever is the Democratic candidate in 16? And now, if you have been following the news, and we've talked about before in this studio, Chris Christie is in real trouble, and his credibility has certainly been undermined by some serious missteps by his staff, if not by him. There's a long time between now and that next election, and who knows what will happen to the world, to the other Democratic candidates, to Hillary, and to the Republicans. So, of course, it's not a foregone conclusion, but it's one of those, I think the pollsters would say, if the election were held today, who would you vote for? And I think based on that, she is the front runner.
Mm. Okay, well, let's jump from Washington to Moscow and turn our attention to Vladimir Putin, who's just announced that actually gay people should feel welcome at the Sochi Winter Olympics. But with the caveat, he said, that they leave the children in peace. But he just can't help himself, can he? what do we make of this? Is he attempting to be nice, or is he just...
It's the old read across that gays are paedophiles. You know, heterosexuals aren't paedophiles. That's part of the language of dictators who want a distraction and a cause. You know, most typically Africans, you know, who've been reared up to go by American evangelists. And he sounds like one of those African leaders now, which says there's a problem in domestic politics if you have to do distracting things like that.
This is, you know, it's not just dictators. George Bush did this, and prior to him, you know, his father and Ronald Reagan. The gay issue in American politics was for a very long time what they called a wedge issue.
Yes.
And it was a very, very convenient way to push the conservative supporters into your camp. Mm. And so I think it's not fair simply to say it's the dictators. I think until recently it was quite useful in democracies. Putin, though, being a man of the 1980s, is very much calling on 1980s ideas. I think what's so interesting about this, Andrew, is what's going to happen during the Olympics. How is this issue going to manifest itself? Because you can be sure there are too many confident people and too many confident people in sport who are either gay or outraged by Putin's approach, who are going to these Olympics. They are going to be heard somewhere, and they are going to disrupt things in a way that is going to throw these Olympics off message. And what's he going to do? Is he going to put them in jail?
The U.S. delegation includes, you know, many gay sports people as well, and gay sports heroes.
As well as Ambassador Billie Jean King. You know, just yesterday at the Today Show, at NBC, the big morning show in New York, host Matt Lauer was out in Rockefeller Center, And there was a disruption by Queer Nation with a huge gay flag live on morning TV in front of 4 or 5 million Americans. That NBC is the Olympic network in America. They've got to be worried about this kind of disruption.
Peter, we're almost out of time. But when you look at, you know, again, he's trying to obviously appeal to his home audience. I don't think he's really got a PR kind of eye on what the West thinks or cares about him.
No, it's very much a home audience thing. And there is a wedge to be driven because it's a very different electorate.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us. You've heard about the wedge, you've heard about the pantsuit, and you've heard about much more.
The weekend begins.
That was, of course, Peter York and Geoffrey Coffin with the day's top stories. And thank you both, gentlemen, for joining us here on Midori House. There's still plenty to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll check in with our woman in Rio, meet the man behind London's Delfina Foundation, and review the week's latest and greatest in cinema. But before we get started on that, we're going to cross over to David Spencer with the world news headlines.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. See on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed. The latest world headlines. The US President Barack Obama has ordered tighter restrictions on the surveillance carried out by the National Security Agency. He said the NSA has to rein in the vast collection of phone data and that they will improve transparency. His speech follows revelations about surveillance after leaks by Edward Snowden. 44 members of the Syrian National Coalition have withdrawn from talks in Turkey on whether to attend next week's peace talks in Switzerland. Meanwhile, the Syrian government has proposed a ceasefire in Aleppo ahead of that summit in Geneva. Thai Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra has again refused to resign as anti-government protests continue in Bangkok. At least 8 people have died in demonstrations that started back in November over a controversial amnesty bill. The Algerian president has signed a decree that gives the go-ahead for a formal start to campaigning for an April election. The announcement is the first public act of Abdelaziz Bouteflika after he returned from hospital in France this week. Anti-government activists in Ukraine have marched on the presidential administration to protest against a law passed on Thursday aimed at curbing more protests. The law follows several massive rallies calling for the president to resign after he rejected a European trade deal for closer ties with Russia. Russian President Vladimir Putin says that gay athletes and visitors to the Sochi Winter Olympics will not face discrimination. But at a meeting of Olympic volunteers, he called on visitors to respect Russia's culture and traditions and leave children in peace. These are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, David Spencer, and welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. The time is now 21:32 in Moscow, and that means it's 18:32 here in London and 16:32 in Rio de Janeiro. And it's time now to check in one of our correspondents around the world, and we're actually heading to Brazil and to Rio de Janeiro and to Sheena Roster, who's armed and ready with the week's top stories. Sheena, welcome to the show. And we want to jump straight in with Brazil's civil aviation. Now, there's been a lot of debate recently about whether the national airlines are going to be able to cope with moving people around the country and an affordable price. So a decision has been made to kind of allow foreign companies to fly within Brazil, to fly internally. But it doesn't actually seem to mean very much, because can anybody actually do it?
Well, actually, there was it wasn't necessarily that they did allow foreign companies to operate within Brazil. Basically, they have released more flights, nearly 2,000 flights, 1,973 flights to be exact, at 25 airports throughout the country during the World Cup period, so June 6th to July 20th. these will be flights that will be operated by domestic and domestic airlines. Of course, there were talks for foreign companies to operate within Brazil during this time period. However, that would have raised various other problems. We're only 5 months away from the World Cup. And of course, these foreign airlines don't necessarily have the infrastructure to operate within Brazil, such as ticketing counters and so on, and not to mention all the bureaucracy that they would have to deal with in order to get set up in such a short period of time. So in the end, it is just going to be local domestic airlines, but they are just added new routes and are operating more routes within Brazil during the World Cup period. So a couple new routes have included Rio, Buenos Aires, even though, of course, Buenos Aires is not in Brazil. It's in Argentina. It's still a highly expected route because a lot of Argentines will be coming over to cheer for their team, which is among one of the favorites during the World Cup. We got Brasilia-Sao Paulo, which is also an added route, and Fortaleza-Sao Paulo. Of course, even though more people are traveling within Brazil using airlines in recent years, the routes have actually been decreased over the years, and that's just a way for airlines to basically have more of a larger profit margin.
Now, tell me, I know also that FIFA are coming to Brazil next week. They're going to be looking at the six of the World Cup stadium that still have not been completed. What's the feeling when you look at the Brazilian press? Is it likely that they're going to be done in time?
Well, the deadline for these six stadiums was December 31st, so basically, no, they have all officially met their deadline. The one that is closest to meeting the deadline is in the northeastern city of Natal, which will be the first of the six of the 12 stadiums which have yet to be delivered for the World Cup. Of course, the first six were delivered last year during the so-called dress rehearsal, the 2013 Confederations Cup. So the last six that are still waiting to be delivered, Natal will be delivering, will be inaugurating its stadium, the Arena das Dunas, on the 22nd of January here, and the president will be in attendance for that.
Now, we've already seen that, you know, some of them are supposed to have got leaky roofs. There was a terrible accident pre-Christmas. The feeling about what's being completed as well, are you seeing reports that people are still concerned about the quality of the build and how these stadia are being built?
There's various concerns around it. Of course, Brasilia is a good example of that. Brasilia was one of the stadiums that was used for the dry run, the Confederations Cup last year. It's been by far the most expensive stadium to build, costing over R$1 billion. And recently, when a women's match was being held there, it was raining, and it proved to show that the roof was leaking on the structure. It was leaking down into the whole lower bowl of the stand. So clearly, that's a big issue, and certainly not going to make Brazilians happy when a lot of public funds have been spent on this, which is why Brazilians have been taking out to the streets in protest.
Now, we talked a lot with you last year about the protests that happened around the time of the bus demonstrations. Many people upset at the attempts to hike prices. There's a new type of demonstration going on, flash mobs. Could you tell us a little bit about how they're being used and what their ambitions are?
Yeah, so basically there's been a recent wave of these so-called flash mobs, which in Brazilian Portuguese they're called rolezinho, which started in Sao Paulo City shopping centers. So they started in early December, where basically groups of teenagers who typically come from the lower middle class have organized themselves via Facebook to meet at shopping centers. And they have managed to get thousands of teenagers together all at once that basically just storm these shopping centers. Of course, this has basically caused a lot of concern because during a lot of these rolezinhos, some of the so-called protesters have basically been arrested by military police for no apparent reason. There have been no robberies apparently taking place. So then this has kind of fueled a bit more racial tensions within Brazil, so to speak, because although Brazil is basically marketed as a country as a so-called racial democracy, of course, there still is a huge gap between the upper class and the lower class, where typically the upper class in Brazil tend to be white and the lower class tend to be black. So a lot of these protests are basically centered more around racism, and the reason why they're particularly focusing on shopping centers is because among the higher class in Brazil, shopping centers were places that they would constantly frequent because it was known as a safe zone from being away from people of the lower classes. But now that these the lower class have entered into the new consumer bracket, it's basically trying to show that this whole segment of the Brazilian population are now new consumers, and it's trying to basically make the upper class segment feel uncomfortable in this area they used to consider safe.
Sheena, I know you are in Rio these days. Used to be in Sao Paulo for us, and Rio people tend to think of it as a little bit safer than Sao Paulo. But for one important gentleman, last night proved to be his last.
Yes, exactly. Basically. Sadly, a few weeks before the famous Rio de Janeiro Carnival, a samba leader has been fatally shot. He was basically shot on January 14th, but he passed away last night. He was shot in the arm and in the stomach, and he was shot. Nobody knows exactly why he was shot, but he was basically shot when he was leaving a rival samba school, Mangueira, and he was part of the famed samba school, Falgueira, here in Rio de Janeiro. So
are there some suspicions he might have been shot because he was visiting a rival camp?
It's all up for speculation. It's hard to say exactly why he was shot, because some of these people in high positions in samba schools, they are kind of involved in dodgy businesses from time to time. So it's really up to speculation. Nobody really knows exactly.
Well, Sheena, I can't say it was the cheeriest check-in we've ever had with Brazil, but thank you for joining us, and I'm sure the clouds will clear one way or another for the country over the coming weeks and months. That was, of course, Sheena Roster, Monocle's woman in Rio de Janeiro. And up next, we're going to meet the man behind the Delfina Foundation, the largest artist residency provider in London. Stay tuned for more on this episode of Midori House on Monocle 24.
Are you tired of overcooked and overrated culinary trends that never quite hit the spot? Fed up of being spoon-fed half-baked ideas on the next big thing? Then tune into The Menu with me, Markus Hippi. Every week we introduce you to the world's top makers and shakers, cocktail creators and the best bread makers as we uncover gourmet street food, big-time baristas and wily wineries.
Once upon a time, it was seen with disdain. But over the years, that culture had gotten so popular, it's iconic now.
If you're serving decent food in East London, don't you got any problem getting custom in? And I worked in the West End for years, you know. I mean, it's not always packed in the West End, trust me.
This is the show that discovers how coffee can change a country and how chocolate can make us live longer, all in the search for exciting local food producers and the most original entrepreneurs.
That's The Menu. Every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
Monocle has shops around the world selling our exclusive collaborations with some of our favourite designers, including Ettinger, Porter, Barena, Jawbone, Oliver Peoples, and many more. You can find us on College Street in Toronto, Hudson and Charles in New York, and in the heart of Wan Chai in Hong Kong, and two in London. So, whether you're after a versatile travelling wardrobe, something for the home, or a present for a loved one, or just missing back issues from your collection, you're sure to find something at the Monocle shop.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Delfina Foundation was founded in 2007 as a place where artists in London could gather, talk and exchange ideas, with a focus on the greater Middle East and North Africa too. Well, now, after a major expansion, Delfina is set to reopen on Monday as London's largest international residency programme. Aaron Cesar, Delfina's founding director, joins me now in the studio to talk through what's to come. Now, let's first of all unpack this a little bit for our listeners so they understand why we're excited to have you in the studio. So what do you provide as Delfina?
Delfina Foundation is one of London's unique residency spaces in the sense that artists live, work, debate, cook, eat, exhibit their work all in one space. And so we provide artists with the opportunity to live and work in London for up to 3 months at a time together and to explore common practices through the context of the residency format.
Now, we hinted there that in the past you've looked at especially the Middle East and North Africa to bring people to London. Is that still where you're drawing people in from?
No, we are with the relaunch of the building, we're also relaunching our programs to be more international in its scope. However, we're going to continue our deep relationships with the Middle East, North Africa, and South Asia by enriching these relationships through more international dialogue. So we're moving away from looking at, let's say, geographical differences, which often cultural exchange kind of preferences, to looking at similarities. So to bring artists together around common practices, the first of which will be around the politics of food.
Now tell me, how long do people come for, and do they have to pay you money, or do you get grants to come there, or?
They do not pay. We work with a series of individuals and foundations. We raise money for the artists to spend time in London and also produce work and research during their periods in residence.
And how long would they typically stay with you?
Anywhere between 1 month to 3 months. For example, our current program involves artists who are coming actually everything from 2 weeks to 3 months, depending on the nature of their research and what they're producing during their residency, whether it's knowledge or an artwork.
Now, give me some idea. You say that the one of the themes now is food. Mm. So what kinds of things would be going on in the building? Mm.
Well, right now we're planning a series of events to take place that really complements our exhibition, which will open on Monday, which is a constellation of artworks that unpick and introduce some of the ideas and issues that will then be researched through the context of the residency. And so, for example, we have Leone Contini, who on Wednesday night is going to be looking at the relationship between kind of Italy and China and looking at through the concept of tea in a tribute to Chairman Mao.
Now, I often wonder when you look at cities, you know, in London's a good example is, you know, that neighbourhoods such as Hoxton, which are in the east of the city, which were taken over by artists, there was spaces for them to go, they were cheap, as chips, as we say. Mm-hmm. Suddenly those areas became super popular and became taken over by wealthy loft livers. The artist gets pushed out further and further. Is this, you know, you're right in Victoria, right in the heart of the city. You're a two-minute walk from the Houses of Parliament. Is this one of the strengths of what you have to offer, that actually in a city which is perhaps turning its back on cheap spaces for artists, you let them come right into the heart of the city?
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at Delfina's history, I mean, the first organization, Delfina Studios, which started actually in Stratford in 1988, then moved to Bermondsey and now Victoria. And it's putting artists back at the heart of the capital. And it's also interesting in a sense that we're also at the seat of government as well. So taking on concepts and themes like the politics of food, begin to also think about how we engage with our neighbors. I mean, our neighbors are politicians, in fact.
Now, many of the people who are coming to you, I presume, you know, they understand how the art world works and they can go anywhere in the world. So I presume you're a little bit in competition, you know, with other institutions in New York and in Europe. What is it about London? Is there still something that attracts artists to the city?
I absolutely think so. I spent a few years in New York before I moved to London. And I think that New York is a multicultural city and London is an international city. In London, I mean, it's just the best that I think the world has to offer. And when we invite artists, without a doubt, when we discuss different contexts for the residencies, because we also do residencies in other cities as well, but primarily London is our stronghold, it's always interesting to find how they bring their practices and actually their culture and relate it to what's happening in London, because it can be found here. And in many times they've kind of come back from, let's say, a day out in London and said, actually, I haven't met a British person today.
Now, tell me also, you know, the name Delfina, where does that come from?
It comes from our founder, who's an amazing woman. She's an 86-year-old philanthropist who, as she says in her own words, collects artists instead of art. And she is, in a way, the mother, the grandmother, kind of the organization and of all artists. So if anyone is looking at their personal needs, it's her, while we look after the professional needs.
And she's still actively involved?
She's incredibly actively involved on a day-to-day basis. And she is not afraid to get her hands dirty and to really develop this real personal sense of connection with the artist, which is very important if they've left home, kind of as it were.
And are people like her increasingly important? You know, we know that for many European governments, they're a bit short of cash and they're kind of cutting back on arts funding and certainly the giving of grants, and especially to giving of grants to people who aren't, for example, in this country, British. So is it the philanthropist now who is key to the success of this world, do you think?
I absolutely think so. And I think what we're also trying to do at Delfina Foundation is to develop relationships with patrons to also increase their own knowledge of the impact of patronage. To support a residency program means that you're actually supporting development of an idea. You're supporting development of a person and their practice. You're not necessarily always going to get an outcome, something to take to a biennale, to sell to a museum, to take home. It's really developing a sense of knowledge. And to do that, we actually have to also develop patronage. And so it's a huge, overwhelming challenge that I think the government has to take on.
And the ribbon cutting, the official ribbon cuttings on Monday?
It actually happened earlier today.
Oh, okay.
Privately to press and to patrons. And it included Ed Vasey, who came along and also spoke about the importance
of our Minister of Culture.
Exactly, our Minister of Culture here to talk about actually the need for more organizations like Delfina Foundation. So it was spectacular.
And who's oddly been a guest this week on Section D, one of our shows here as well. Well, Aaron, thank you very much for coming to see us.
That You're
was the Delfina Foundation's director, Aaron Cesar. Well, we're going to have a little bit of a musical interlude now, because up next we're reviewing the latest film releases, including Wolf of Wall Street. And taking us there appropriately, this is Wolf and I by Oland. Well, that was The Wolf and I by Oland. And you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. And we're fast approaching the end of the programme. But as promised, just before that track, it's time for our daily review segment, where we go through the best in books, theatre, art, music and cinema with our correspondents and contributors from around the world. Today, we talk film. And I'm glad to say that joining us now to go through the latest releases is film critic Alex Godfrey. Welcome to the show, Alex. Now, we're going to jump straight in with, of course, thanks to Oland, The Wolf of Wall Street, Martin Scorsese's film. Tell us your take on this. It's got 5 Academy Awards. It's certainly won over...
Nominations.
Oh, sorry.
Easy.
Corrected me. Very good there. He's got 5 nominations. May get 5 awards, you never know. So it's certainly been popular already with the Hollywood set. What was your take?
Oh, it's an incredibly impressive film. And I think people just also love the fact that Scorsese is still here at the top of his game, doing something so masterful. And it's also really different. It's a really unique, impressive bit of filmmaking that's quite unlike anything else in quite a lot of ways.
In what ways is it quite unlike anything? What is impressive about it?
There's nothing particularly conventional about it. I mean, I don't know how much people know. It's about a real guy, Jordan Belfort, who was a horrid, horrid person who made millions and millions and millions and millions each year by ripping other rich people off. But it's really 3 hours of him and his stock cronies doing terrible things and being terrible people. But it's not conventional storytelling. It's not a morality tale. It's been criticized in some quarters for being a celebration of that sort of excess. It's not. It's just a portrait of it. But it's really relentless and excessive, and it's beautifully done.
Well, let's hear a little bit of that relentless excessiveness.
My name is Jordan Belfort. The year I turned 26, I made $49 million, which really pissed me off because it was 3 shy of a million a week.
We're making a name for ourselves.
Nobody knows if the stock is going to go up, down, sideways, or in circles. You know what a Fugazi is?
No. Oh, Fugazi. It's a fake.
Hey, Fugazi, Fugazi. It's a wazi, it's a woozy, it's a fairy dust.
Was all this legal? Absolutely not. We were making more money than we knew what to do with.
We don't work for you, man.
Yeah, my money taped to your boobs. Technically, you do work for me.
Now, the lead role, of course, is played by Leonardo DiCaprio. A return to form for him?
Oh, he's always good. Do you think that he needed to return to form?
I'm not sure, actually. I find he kind of does his thing, and I don't always get kind of carried away with it. And then suddenly he will pull out a performance which I just think is just magical. And I don't know that he's always as engaging as I expect him to be.
I agree. I actually think he's always great. I think often if he's not, I think it's because he's slightly miscast. I think he's as good as this and as he's ever been, if not better in some ways. He really suits the role. And it was actually a project that he found years ago and he took to Scorsese. And he really fits it well, actually. You do believe him in it.
So we're heartily recommending that and not getting too caught up in the morality of whether it's good or bad. Just go and get stuck in.
Yeah, enjoy it for what it is. I think, you know, if you're going to get sucked into that world and be attracted to it, then there's probably something wrong with you in the first place.
Okay. All right. Our second film is Crystal Fairy. Explain this one.
All right. This is a tiny, tiny, beautiful, really pretty, fascinating little film by a Chilean director called Sebastian Silva, who did a great film a few years ago called The Maid. He made this on the fly very quickly, very cheaply, with a handful of crew, a handful of actors. And it's based on a real experience he had years and years and years ago, where he met a new age hippie chick at a party and said, "Why don't you come up north to the desert with me and my friends and drink some mescaline from a cactus?"
Now, it's a proper Chilean film. Is it in Spanish or is it in?
No, it's mostly in English, and the star is Michael Cera. I mean, Michael Cera was actually living in Chile. He'd seen Silva's other film, The Maid, and sought him out, said he wanted to work with him. Silva had a film which he adapted for Cera to be in, and Silva went to live in Chile and hang out with Silva's family and learn Spanish and make this other film. But the funding was taking some time, and they said, well, Sebastian Silva said, "I've got an idea. This happened to me years ago. I always thought it might be a good film. Let's just go north and make it. I'll get my brothers together. We'll go and make a film." And they got the funding and casting together in a matter of weeks, and they did it. And it's beautiful that it came out so well.
Okay, well, let's move on to the final film, which again has had a huge amount of positive publicity. It's Inside Llewellyn Davis by the Coen brothers. And again, your feelings about this movie.
If you're a Coen Brothers fan, you're going to love it. I mean, it's absolutely everything you'd want from a Coen's film. Its protagonist is deluded and self-important and wry, but not completely unself-aware. They throw a load of curveballs at him, and everything that could get in his way does get in his way, and it's really smart and very funny and very pretty.
Well, good. If you didn't know what to go and see over the coming weeks, you do now. Alex, thank you very much for joining us. That was the film critic, Alex Godfrey. And that's all we have time for on today's show. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Peter York and Jeffrey Kaufman of ABC. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Hayley Ott, and also Luis Mendoza. And our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Next on the menu, we will meet the team behind Spapace, a design and architect firm in Copenhagen who have designed the interiors of some of the most influential restaurants for the last decade. Then at 2200 hours, it's the Monocle Daily with Andrew Muller and Dominic Reynolds. This show is going to be back at the same time on Monday at 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's time for me to say goodbye and have a great weekend.
Tells the story of a passion for motor racing, a legend forged over time by the pioneers of speed and great drivers. The Daytona Cosmograph, the watch made to break barriers, the watch dedicated to endurance, the watch that was born to race. Rolex.